Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
This is Mike Cosentino.
And our researcher and producer.
And Gary LeMaster, yeah.
We have a guest in the studio today, Dr. David Berman, and he's a distinguished professor emeritus from ASU. He's written 10 books on a whole variety of subjects of intergovernmental relations and so forth. He's written more than 70 papers. And we're going to be talking hello,
hello,
Professor.
I'm glad to be here.
We're going to be talking about dark money. Dark money is a term, and I guess we've been doing programs probably every year for the last 4 years on it. So, Professor, why don't we go over, and what is, when people talk about dark money, let's tell folks, what are they talking about? What do they mean, and what's the impact
of it? Just a minute, Steve. Didn't the professor just make a speech in town?
Yes, he did, at the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, two speeches in here and in Clarksdale. Oh. Clarksdale, yeah. I've really enjoyed going to Clarksdale because part of my research has covered United Verde, W.A. Clark, and W.A. Clark is a good way to start talking about dark money because, although it wasn't particularly dark, at least campaign finance, Clark was the, he was a prospector an actual miner in Montana and became very wealthy as an investor in Butte area. And then he purchased the United Verde in here in Jerome. And he was a practical guy. He was a businessman who needed help from the legislature, or at least maybe to fend him off from doing something to him. And he would send down piles of money and buy a few territorial legislators to get what he wanted. And in Montana, he purchased his way into the U.S. Senate. At the time, state legislators were determining who was going to be in the U.S. Senate, and he just bought his way in.
Isn't there a really clear comparison between W.A. Clark and today?
Because
he did it very openly, and I don't think they're trying to hide much.
Well, no, but what he did, interestingly enough, I think that what was interesting, they asked him all about this, and he said, well, you know, I never bought anyone who wasn't for sale. which sort of got an insight into the mindset of the person who was in business. You do what you have to do in business. Yes, it's a quid pro quo, you know.
Exactly.
They want money, I want that bill. It tells you why people get involved in politics and in these kind of operations.
It was very direct. He wanted something done, and he just gave you a bag of money, and you
You're
voted
right,
the way
yeah.
you wanted.
Well, is something wrong with that? I mean, that's free enterprise, isn't it? I mean, it's a quid pro quo.
Real quickly, Empty Mansions is a great biography about W.A. Clark, if you have an interest. Empty Mansions is the name of the book written by, co-written by his daughter.
Yeah. His daughter just passed away, I think. She just passed away.
Yeah, 103.
103.
Clarksdale, for folks who are maybe listening to us on the Internet and not from the Verde Valley, is a really interesting place. It is an old company town
right.
with the whole structure of a company town and was one time divided up by your role in the company. You got a certain size house.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
If you were a miner, you got a certain size house. If you were a manager, and divided up ethnically by street.
Right. Things have changed so much.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
Modern reforms is that's all done.
Yeah,
and he was a character briefly on a series, a very good series. I think it was on HBO called Deadwood.
Yeah.
He was portrayed as a sort of what we would call a robber baron.
Mm-hmm. Along
well,
with
that's first.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, his era was the era of the robber barons, the trusts, the monopolies, and people were genuinely concerned about the influence of these people on politics. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, whatever, whoever, George Hunt, who was first governor of Arizona, these people were, Hunt called the corporations the beast. And he was concerned particularly with two railroads, Santa Fe and the Southern Pacific, and also the giant mining corporations, United Verde and Phelps Dodge. These were the beasts, and they were running the state. He called it the invisible government because this nobody really knew it. Where the hidden contributions, hidden dark money comes in again, because you're talking about things going on that people don't know about. And Hunt was very concerned about that. So I think we have a tradition of concern here. And we're talking, as your quick first question, we're talking about money that's not revealed. It goes into campaigns. We don't know who's giving it. Because of the Citizens United decision in 2010, becoming a growing problem of wealthy people, corporations putting money into campaigns, actually, a lot of that money winds up in very negative personal attacks when nobody knows where the money's coming
from.
For
instance, in the governor's race, do you have any idea the percentage of dark money versus visible money that was put into the race? Or let's take Corporation Commission, for example.
Yeah. I think on the governor's race, well, you have, outside money that comes from super PACs and PACs that is not dark, at least officially. And then you have the 501c4s, the social welfare organizations that are putting money in. And these people... in the last go-around, the governor race 2014, Ducey and Duvall raised about $5 million apiece. That's where their campaign spent. And the outside forces were about $9 million. More money came from the outside forces. Of that, about perhaps half came from dark money.
And apparently now in the presidential race on the Republican side, there's more money in the PACs. In dark money than the Republican Party has.
That's probably true. Yeah. People, the dark money is sort of hard to trace because a lot of the groups that don't have to report their donors give their monies to the PACs, and the PACs will report that money, but they'll report it by the name of the dark money group.
Yeah.
So that it's, you know, they get the money. Where'd you get the money? I got it from the Americans for Freedom
Federal,
for Pets and something
so
like that.
There's a federal rule that they have to report their donors, but then their donors are groups that can't be traced.
Yeah,
right?
That don't have to report
it's,
their
it's
donors.
It's a money laundering operation.
Yeah,
you take it from one social welfare group. They call them disregarded entities, and they pick up these social welfare organizations, use them for political purposes, completely disregard the IRS rules, and just funnel money from one to the next. And by structure, the social welfare groups don't have to report their donors.
Yeah, so that's a lot of the dark money winds up going through groups that have to report the money. it makes it very difficult to trace. Yeah.
Does everybody understand that works? So there are some rules that say that they have to report who their donors are. But if you have a second group hiding behind there with hidden money, then it's really, really hard to trace where the money is. Unless they make some kind of a mistake.
I know you probably want to talk about it, but the proposition that's maybe on the ballot here has an interesting kick to it. Terry Goddard and Chuck Coughlin have put together, and that says if you can't, they're asking people who spend money to tell us where they got it from, and if they the original contributor, and if they can't spend the money, which is an interesting piece of that's going to be challenged right away. But that was a way of getting to it.
What that bill has, that bill got a number?
It's a proposition. It's going to be on the bail.
I'm sorry. I
don't know what the number is, but it just as was announced last week, they had the language together. They're pairing that with the, in a campaign sense, with the top two primary that it's going to be coming back to the ballot again if they get enough signatures. So they need 260,000 names, I guess, on a signature.
There was a movement nationally to force corporations to reveal to the shareholders that the money they put into political contributions. There was also a movement for the IRS to hold these disregarded entities and social welfare groups accountable for not spending the majority of their money in politics. But during the negotiations for the omnibus spending bill, Republicans added two amendments that basically blocked both of those movements. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I know the IRS has, well, all the federal agencies have sort of backed off, really. The FEC, is Federal Elections Commission, has three Democrats, three Republicans. What can they do?
On the Daily Show, one of the members of the commission said that, was asked, to compare the commission with the teats on a boar, and she thought it was a fair comparison.
The IRS, too, has, you know, they did get at one time into looking at some of the social welfare groups, and unfortunately, they were all conservative groups, and that caused a great big stink.
The interesting thing that we were talking about one time is that basically all the groups they were investigating were all guilty. I mean,
none of them
were actually social welfare groups.
No, they weren't.
There were reason to flag them all because they're all political groups pretending to be social welfare groups. How is this going? Is it getting worse and worse?
Yeah, there was a report that the amount of dark money in as of November 20th or something like that was 10 times greater than it was during the last, a comparable period in the last election cycle for president, so that the amount of money is growing. There's several groups online that sort of track this stuff, and they're making predictions of a great influx of dark money.
Koch brothers had announced that they would spend $900 million plus for this election cycle. They're probably going to exceed $1 billion, and most of that is through their what has been dubbed the Cocktopus, where it's this network of social welfare groups and PACs and super PACs.
Right, yeah. And they're sort of they're spreading. So now they have, you know, they've had for a while sort of a phony Hispanic Latino group, and now they're having phony environmental groups and all kinds of variations. They're trying to soften their image. When I lived in New York, they're buying major cultural attractions and putting Koch brothers on top of them. I guess the question is, we see all the bits and pieces, and I don't know how much the public understands the depth of this.
Yeah, I think that's true. I guess one of the debating points about trying to do anything about it is, does the public really care? If everything was disclosed, would that make any difference? Would people vote any differently? And I know that Sean Noble, who works for the Koch Enterprises, makes that argument, you know, although you sort of wonder why they're putting all that money in there if it doesn't make any difference. But they sort of make the argument that, you know, we can't buy elections and people vote on different reasons. And if you get all these regulations on, it's not going to make much difference because people aren't acting on that basis. Not Terry Goddard, when he came up with this latest proposition that's beyond the ballot, makes the other argument that people really, well, a lot of us want to know, of course, but yeah. but people, if they're well educated and they do know, and the word gets out, will make it, that will become a part of their agenda.
Those are two big ifs for sure.
They are big ifs, yeah.
Let's ask that question. Why aren't people more concerned?
I should say that the Morris Institute, which I hear about every once in a while, did a survey not too long ago that showed that 87% of the public thinks dark money is a problem. And it would be a good campaign issue to run on, even though you might want to do anything afterwards because you'll get dark money to help your election.
But well, that's, if they know about it, they yeah. care about it. But
I think that's true.
I think
yeah.
part of the problem is in this climate today, Dr. Berman, that this facade of nonpartisanship, the other side is forcing partisanship. But the League of Women Voters, nonpartisan group for many years, they brought you up to talk about dark money.
They're a 501c4, by the way.
Exactly. The Interfaith, the Arizona Interfaith Council, again, another supposedly nonpartisan, but things have gotten so bad and so clearly corrupt.
Yeah.
That partisanship, and I would throw the Morrison Institute into that too, that if they want to help, if they want to provide information, then they've got to tell the truth, and the truth is partisan, sir.
Well, the truth is partisan. You're quite right. I think that it's in politics, the people who benefit where the system are going to defend it. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And most of the money that is so far, one survey to show that 87% of the money spent in 2014 on dark money went to conservative causes. The balance is very overwhelmingly on one side, and that's why you have trouble in the FEC and Congress
and the poor,
just about anybody.
Poor hapless Democrats that get involved in this. This is like children running the show here. They've gotten involved in dark money simply because you have to. It's foolish if the other side is doing so much. As you said, we're talking, nine tenths of the dark money being spent on the right.
Well, I'm sort of impressed though by the Chuck Conklin's no flaming liberal, and Terry Goddard's of course a standard Democrat for many years. They got together, and I think even Tea Party people might say there's something wrong with hidden money, and us not knowing. I don't think that the arguments are against it are sort of. Doing something are not particularly good, I don't think, for most people.
I don't think they want to get in an argument about dark money, because if they get into a big public argument about it, I think people will become concerned.
Yeah, you're right.
I guess my question, and Mike and Gary have theirs, is what's the long-term implications of more and more dark money determining our election? In other words, can American democracy survive in an environment where not only dark money, but vast contributions by a few billionaires are determining who's the candidates for president and how well they do?
Sort of. Sometimes it's a case of your billionaire against my billionaire. You know, you try to line up on both sides, but what happens when you do that? Even is you. You drowned out the other people. The freedom of speech for the rich and the corporate well-off is, if you exercise it fully, deprives other people of their speech because you're drowned out. I mean, how can you compete with people who are... Take the Corporation Commission. That election was the whole narration of the election, the whole story was the outside money that came in, the dark money. The candidates don't count. and nobody else has any speech because they've got the whole market and there's no way of talking back, so there is a problem there. I think
we've just invited APS to come on the show and deny that they contributed any dark money to the Corporation Commission that regulates them. We say, are the invitation stands, APS, if you want to come and come on the show and make a statement that you didn't do all this
stuff, confirm
come
or ahead. Deny. That's sort of those arguments, and it's sort of hard to know where they are.
I was glad to see that you mentioned the 87% being for conservatives, because and when you talk about our billionaire against their billionaire, I like to address the false equivalency. People think, whenever you hear something about Fox News, for example, being biased, you always hear in retort MSNBC. Well, they're hardly the same. There's almost no comparison between the two. When you talk about the billionaires for conservatives and the billionaires for Democrats, there are many more for Republicans than there are for Democrats.
Well, that's true.
And it's the structural imbalance between the funding of the two sides, the two parties, is dramatic.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of the corporations give to both sides.
That's true.
Because their only concern is really winning and having access afterwards.
Yeah. I've talked to people who worked for large corporations who donated money to candidates, and they said basically if the candidate is friendly to us, we don't care what party they are. We donate to people who we think are going to win.
Yeah, right.
And
exactly.
So, but even that money is deeply skewered toward Republicans. When we look at, you know, they will give 65% of the money to Republicans, and they will give the rest of it to a Democrat. What I'm worried about, Professor, is the impact of this on American democracy. If billionaires speak with all their money, if their money is free speech, what does that do to the rest of us who are not?
Well, I think it diminishes our speaking effectiveness. We simply are not going to be able to compete with the billionaires. And that is detrimental to democracy, I think, because you're letting other people determine who we see and what we hear, and that's the problem that bothers me the most. And also, you know, freedom of speech becomes the freedom to try to buy an election.
And it certainly seems like people will care about that.
I think that's a good point. It's freedom to buy an election. Citizens United has opened that up.
That's right. Yeah, and the remedy, probably the best remedy, is to a constitutional amendment to get rid of Citizens United, or to make sure that you have to worry about the Supreme Court in the future.
Which all the Democratic candidates are in favor of.
Yeah.
We have to say that kind of thing. This is a partisan show. Yeah. I want to ask you, you wrote a book called Arizona Politics and Government with a great title. You called it Arizona. It's 1998, published anyway.
Yeah.
Arizona Politics and Government, The Quest for Autonomy, Democracy, and Development.
Right.
What's changed since 1998, since you wrote that book, other than what you just said, which was huge?
Yeah. Well, let's write that down.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a book.
Sounds like you're writing a book.
Yeah, you're writing another one. Yeah. I'm doing another book. It has more on the progressive movement and its relevancy.
Progressive movement in Arizona?
Yeah, well, no.
Oh, I was going to say.
I need a lot of data.
all three of us.
That'd be the slimmest book.
I was thinking of coming in here. It's like Radio Free Europe here. You know, broadcasting out there.
Yeah, no.
The French resistance.
We feel that way a lot.
Yes. But we need looking for an armed posse. But go ahead.
No, I think those are the three themes that I found going through, because I looked at them as what people sort of thought is lacking in Arizona in a way, more goals rather than description of reality. You know.
I see.
And
repeat them, autonomy, development, and democracy.
I think autonomy is resurging now with the legislature refusing to honor federal statutes.
Well, they want to take over
federal.
That one's coming back.
They're also autonomous from the general public, the people that elected them. You know, they say one thing, like our candidates in our district always say they're jobs and education, you know, candidates, and in their entire time in the legislature, they've not mentioned either word once, let alone
They spend a lot of time trying to seize the lands that the American government holds for the American people for their own purposes. Many of them don't believe in public ownership of land. They want to sell off the national parks and monuments and develop them. Or if you can make more money having a park, fine. If you can't, then it becomes a uranium mine.
Governor Hunt was a little bit like that. He thought that Arizona had the right to anything that came through our state. The water was the Colorado River is ours. We can take as much water out of there as we want. You know, that's not just interstate stream, no, nothing. You know, it's just our water. And I think that there's people like that today who think the air pollution we'll take care of it coming over Arizona. You worry about it if it goes into Mexico. It's a state's rights kind of compartmentalizing all kinds of problems.
Wasn't there a controversy when the state was first became a state? Wasn't there a battle between Arizona and the government at that time over public lands.
You're right. Yeah.
So not much has changed since 1912, isn't it?
Oh, well, with the railroads tried to swap some worthless land for some good land, you know, and they went to Congress. We had a guy named Mulford Windsor, who was one of Hunt's, very close to Hunt, who was land commissioner here, and he prevented that, and he also kept the land in trust. A lot of states sold off their public land just right away to make a few bucks. And he said, well, we're going to keep this for education, and we're going to keep it forever. You know, it's going to be...
And now we're going to sell it off.
We're going back the other way. But that was considered to be a major coup for the state, you know, to prevent Congress from doing that.
What group did you speak to in Clarkdale?
Where?
In Clarkdale?
Clarkdale. It was the League of Women Voters. They have two... well, they have different meeting places. I guess there's the...
I see.
The
so you spoke to the same group twice?
No, a different group. Same group, different people. Yeah.
So what did you tell them? I'm just interested to find out what you told this group about dark money.
Well, pretty much what we're talking about here, really. And then the league is, I think there are a lot of people in the league who are concerned about finance and politics. They were... interested in the proposition that's going to be on the ballot, and the Citizens United. I did fill in some historical background and quite a few questions.
So 6 years into Citizens United, even the League of Women Voters is concern about...
I think even as... League of Women Voters has had a long-time concern with good government, and that's, you know, they were formed after the women got the right to vote, and they were there to help them make good use of that right and educate them, keep them up to... They have men, by the way, now. It's not just...
I
remember Mayor Daley going in when they were all women and saying, greetings to the women, men and women of the League of Women Voters,
I'm a member. My wife asked me to join with her, so I joined.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand that probably the League of Women Voters was concerned from day one about Citizens United, as we remember talking about, the main vehicle that just blew the lid off of dark money.
Well, I think so, yeah.
And yet, it's just now that they're... So I'm going back to my problem with partisanship. In other words, trying to keep it under the radar for 6 years has not worked. And certainly, I believe that the league is coming out now because they don't have to worry about paying a price for their for their fear or for their partisanship, because there's nothing to lose. The other side has so much money, they are buying elections.
I guess
it's a good issue. It's a good issue for Democrats and
a good issue for the League of Women Voters
and a good for the league too. But I think there's something to be said for... I think people can agree to do things for very different reasons. And to say it's a partisan issue on this side against that side sometimes cuts off support you might have on the other side. Very often when I get into public, because I taught for many years, and there are always kids that are very polarized, you know, and you sort of look for that, and you phrase it, and it works quite effectively. Our problems are common problems; they're not partisan problems. I think, and we all really ought to be looking for that happy medium where we can do something.
I think that's the right approach. I think turning everything into partisan... The problem that we see is that so much of the money is on one side.
Well, that's true.
That will give that side, and it's a Republican and conservative big business side, that gives them a tremendous investment in keeping dark money dark.
That's true, yes. I agree with you. Although I have found recently one of the trends that's sort of interesting. You talked about stockholders and investors being very unhappy about that sometimes.
Right.
And I think that you find a lot of corporations now are actually voluntarily disclosing their contributions because it's a nuisance. I mean, they are having, I think they're feeling some of the pressure. And there's a, I have it in here somewhere, a growing number of Fortune 500 corporations that are doing it. The ones that aren't, like the Chamber of Commerce, are just, you know.
Right.
You know, they see it as a partisan issue. You know, you're trying to silence conservatives and Republicans, and that's why you...
The National Chamber of Commerce is, in some ways, almost a money laundering outfit that disguises where the funds are coming from. A few times they found out, it's fairly shocking. The money is going directly to an issue that benefits a particular narrow band of industry.
It's been labeled by about recently by one of the media as the most the darkest of the dark money groups.
Yeah, it is.
That it's highly partisan. And it's, you know,
there's been no whistleblowers either, Gary.
You always have to separate the Chamber of Commerce. When you talk about the chamber, the local chambers are great. The only problem with the local chambers is they have to contribute money up the chain to go to the U.S. chamber. When you get to the U.S. chamber or even the state chamber of commerce, they are very partisan, and they don't represent the small business people that are the you know, the heart of the organization.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. They're on the diehard list, and some of them argue they can't be revealed as her contributions because of boycotts or some kind of retaliation from powerful politicians, or and they think of themselves as John Jay Madison, and
it's the whole thing.
Their argument is that we have to give the money secretly, because if people found out we were giving it for this particular cause, they might get pissed off.
Yeah, right.
That's the Sean Noble argument.
Yeah, yeah. Consumers and investors but you know, God, if you put money into a corporation and they're giving money to something that you don't like, I think that's
they'd be wise to follow my parents' advice of don't do anything anonymously that you wouldn't do.
Stand up for your beliefs. I think there's I think all the arguments are pretty much, frankly, if you're making this a campaign issue, it's much easier to attack dark money than it is to defend it. And the Democrats would be far better off doing the attack. Republicans would be put on their heels, I think, a little bit.
Let me go back to an earlier question. Is the amount of dark money, I think that Gary and Mike and I would agree, seems to be getting more pronounced and more defining of our elections. So we become concerned, Professor Berman, about survival of our democracy if there's these vast sources of first open money from giant corporate entities, and then billionaires for some of the Republican candidates. Rubio, for example, most of his career has been supported by a single billionaire.
And
I guess that's really personally disturbing. I mean, I think you can hear it in Mike's questions to us.
Yeah, well, I think that's a legitimate concern. Though you have Donald Trump as an alternative, I suppose, because he doesn't have to go to other people. And I don't know if Democrats feel any more comfortable with Donald Trump. But there is the spectacle of people going to the billionaires every year, you know, and trying to, the Koch brothers or whoever they are, trying to get their support. That sort of screens out, if you don't have a billion of your own, you have to get it from somebody else, and it screens out those who can't get that billion. So there is a problem of oligarchy, of a government.
Our representative, Sylvia Allen, raised $40,000-$50,000and had $140,000 spent on her behalf to get her seat in the Senate, Arizona Senate, for legislative district, Valdez 6.
Yeah.
Some people would say, and I would say, that clearly the outside money bought her seat. On her own, in her district, she could not raise enough money to get elected. To beat her competition.
Well, isn't the party advantage very strong here for Republicans?
Oh, yes. Very, very much.
I would think that any Republican could probably...
They don't need money.
So you're suggesting that Sylvia Allen's campaign spent $140,000 that they didn't have to spend?
I honestly do think that Christine Jones, there are a lot of people who run for office who blow the money.
There's a current example with Jeb Bush. I was watching the Daily Show last night, and they were talking about he spent so far on his presidential campaign $40 million of other people's money.
Yeah, right.
And for absolutely no gain. They were discussing the things that he might have spent that $40 million on, like a new water plant for Flint, Michigan.
There you are. Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of money is wasted in government.
That's an interesting idea that a lot of it is just, we see the billions being spent. A lot of it is just, look at the money poured into the last election for some of the candidates. American elections are winner take all, situation. Yeah. So if you give your money to somebody who loses, your money kind of disappears anyway.
Right. Yeah. That's right. It's success breeds success. I mean, really, if you carve up your legislative district so that they're so lopsided,
there isn't a hell of a lot you can do about anything.
I guess we should go there. What can be done?
I was just going to ask the same thing. We've kind of identified a lot of problems, and one we haven't even talked about is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is another form of dark money. What solutions would you propose? For dark money in general, short of a constitutional amendment.
I think people who are concerned about the dark money really should focus on reversing Citizens United. You might think about changing. It was a 5-4 decision, making sure that the next president is the kind of person who's going to appoint people who can.
Another justice
might do well. There are alternatives in a way. I think a clean elections commission and public financing is a way of offsetting at least some of the disparity in financing. That can be... Seattle's coming up with for municipal elections. They just adopted a voucher system where people would be getting a voucher for $100 or so that they could give the candidate their choice. This sort of gets more people involved, and it gets more small contributions into the
That's
into
the other problem, isn't it? It's the lack of involvement, particularly younger people in the elections.
That's true.
I have to admit, I've done my share of trying to get younger people involved in elections, and the first thing that happens is that they're turned off by being asked for money constantly. So all of a sudden, they realize there's something wrong. Their student loans are killing them, and they get involved in politics, and then they get 10,000 emails asking them for money. Now, we're sort of jaded and used to it, but you had them for a minute, and then you lose them.
We also don't have any money to give, so we can just delete some messages.
That's why you give them the voucher.
I think that's a great idea.
The Daily Show had an innovative solution that somebody had come up with this, and they were just covering it as a story. The idea of betting on elections. They wanted to legalize betting on elections, make it like fantasy football, and they put together a group of young men who knew nothing about politics, and then said gave them some money to bet on the elections, and within a half an hour they were quite intelligent about politics.
We kind of dodged the bullet in some ways. I mean, in the last presidential election, but. Are we in danger of becoming more and more an oligarchy if nothing is done?
Yes, I think that's true. I think we're going to find if one side's getting all their money from the rich, the other side's going to try and get it too. I mean, as much as they can. I think it's not just lobbying. Not just campaigns. It's lobbying too. You know, the lobbying campaigns are very hard to be financed in one direction. Alex is there, it's
I guess the real danger is you hear it just pretty much from one side. There's the really the voice that might be useful to hear is not heard because you're drowned out by the money that's poured into the other side. The Koch brothers have investments. You know, universities sometimes take money.
They control whole economics departments.
Right. Yeah, there are things that are happening there that I'm not. Many people are not too happy about, but they're controlling the message. Yeah. And when you start controlling the message like that, then you really have to.
And the best, the focus you think first is you need to try to elect people who are as independent from dark money as possible, and then there needs to be a constitutional amendment that undoes Citizens United.
Yeah, I think the second one there. Yeah, I think electing people who. I guess you're right. People who are not dependent on dark money. Sometimes you wonder, you know, people who campaign against dark money all of a sudden get a lot of dark money to help their campaign, and all of a sudden they're not upset about dark money anymore.
Well, the cat is out of the bag. The Gillens and Page study, you know, from Princeton that we talked about on the show, the Gillens and Page study about that America is no longer a democracy, that they used 1,800 policy decisions from the 1980s to 2012, and the conclusion was that these policy decisions were bought and paid for by wealthy individuals.
The policy decisions that were put into effect were the policy decisions that the wealthy and the powerful wanted, whether they were popular or not. And it didn't matter whether they were social liberal things or conservative economic things. It's a stunning report because it's a fairly large study.
There was a story I saw online from Demos, a group that found that 200 of the Americans' most politically active corporations spent $5.8 billion on federal lobbying and campaign contributions between 2007 and 2012. But they got back $4.4
trillion. Wow. Great investment.
It's a great investment. The more you contribute, the more you're going to get back.
Let's repeat that. Why don't we repeat that? Because I think that's new information to me.
Yeah, I picked it up it was on the online 9/14/2015. Demos, a public policy group, found that between 2007 and 2012, 200 of America's most politically active corporations spent a combined $5.8 billion on federal lobbying and campaign contributions. But they got back, in terms of federal business and support, some $4.4 trillion.
So it made economic sense.
Oh, it makes great sense. You and I don't give that much.
No.
What happens is that, you know, when we get very little back.
I sent my $19 to the Sanders campaign yesterday, and I'm not expecting anything.
Yeah, no, right. And I give money, and I don't expect anything from back.
Maybe a bumper sticker.
If I gave him $2 million, I might expect something.
You know, I would, too.
I'd like to kind of put this in perspective. If you know, since you've written about, you know, some of the era of the robber barons to some degree, how did we get out of this? I mean, we're repeating the robber barons era. How did we get out of this?
Well, we had a populist and progressive movement. We had people who were really concerned about the various things you're asking about, the people, the wealthy carrying the country and influencing public policy. And they came up with bans and corporate contributions. You know, this stuff that the Citizens United got rid of has been there for centuries, for probably 100 years. So we did have a successful political movement. We had Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and I think Teddy Wilson was with Benny Goodman. But it worked.
We'd like to thank Professor David Berman for being with us today. He's written, you're never going to be able to read all 10 of his books and 70 of his academic articles.
Unless you get started now.
Yeah, but I really thank you for being with us. Yeah. And we need to keep this discussion of dark money going, because I have felt since we started 4 years ago that, and I think Mike, I know, feels the same way, that dark money is going to be a perennial issue. And until this is solved, the American democracy as a democracy is in some stress, if not danger.
Yeah, if you don't recognize the country, it's not because of Obama. You can get this and all our shows on VVID.org. Please go to VVID.org and listen to our podcast for this show and all our shows. See you next week.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.